the women will say, literally say, is that really me? Because they'll say, I am beautiful, and I didn't know that.
Celebrity photographer Jeremy Cowart takes snapshots of homeless people.
You know, a lot of people say, well, why would you give a print to a homeless person? And you wouldn't believe what that means to them.
Also on this week's World Vision Report, civilians in Sri Lanka return home after time in a refugee camp. And it's been almost a year since the failure of the Deepwater Horizon started spewing oil into the Gulf of Mexico. We check in with the Gulf's musical ambassadors, the Mamu Playboys.
You know, we live close to the bone. There's nothing fancy. You know, one thing that we do want to hold on to and take care of is our music, our way of life, the simple things that give us pleasure.
I'm Melinda Pencava, around the world with the World Vision Report. First, this news. Welcome to the World Vision Report. I'm Melinda Pencava, in for Peggy Waymeyer. From the unrest in the Middle East to the devastation in Japan, the flow of recent news has been at times heartbreaking. So when we heard about a group here in the U.S. trying to change lives with a snapshot, we wanted to take a closer look. Photos of ourselves and our loved ones are among the things most of us take for granted. We pull a photo out of our wallet or show a family shot on our phones. Now, imagine being homeless and not having these images. Enter the celebrity photographer, Jeremy Cowart. He set out to help the homeless and came up with an idea so elemental that it seemed to border on brilliant. The World Vision Report's Rachel Louise Snyder spoke to Jeremy Cowart about his nonprofit organization, Help Portrait.
The idea is just to get photographers together to provide free portraiture to people in need. And not only do we take their pictures, but we actually bring printers to the location and give them prints, a reflection of themselves that they can hold on to. And it sounds very simple, but a lot of the people we photographed have never in their lives had a single picture taken.
What does that mean for somebody?
Well, instead of me trying to describe it, I thought it would be good for me to just read some quotes from both photographers and participants, if that's okay.
Absolutely.
All right. So these are pulled from our website where a bunch of people sent in their stories on our blog. And so somebody from Miami, Florida said, I never knew that a stranger could be so caring as to take the time to give me my first ever picture with my kids and ask nothing in return. Somebody from Calgary said, whenever I'm down on myself, I'm going to pull out this picture and remind myself how lucky I am. You captured me in a way that I don't ever see myself. So this starts to paint a picture for you that this is way more than just a simple photograph.
I want to back up and just ask you for a minute. Many of us have hundreds and thousands of photos of ourselves or our loved ones just sitting around the house. When did you, do you remember that moment when you came to realize that this wasn't actually the case for everyone?
You know, I don't know that there was a moment where I realized that it wasn't the case, because at first, to me, it was just a really simple idea, just a unique way to give back. I think in a lot of ways, I was just as shocked as anybody else as to how much this meant to the people we were photographing. And so, yeah, to me, I think it was a huge, beautiful surprise.
How do people learn about the project, people who want their photo taken?
A lot of times we partner with nonprofits, you know, whether it's homeless victims or abuse victims or even your next door neighbor who lives alone and doesn't have any friends. It's you know, when we say people in need, we're talking about literally anybody that could just use something to be uplifted.
You take volunteer photographers who are professional and also amateur shooters too, right?
Yeah, because it's not really about good photography. I mean, it's about just simply using a camera as a tool. So you don't have to be a professional photographer. You just have to have, you know, a camera of some sort and the desire to want to help somebody. The point is to connect with people, not necessarily to take amazing pictures. I mean, the pictures are just the catalyst to bring people together.
So what kind of reactions do you get from people?
Yeah, the women will say, literally say, is that really me? Because they'll say, I am beautiful and I didn't know that. And so Help Portrait can literally change someone's perspective on themselves. To see themselves glammed up, you know, maybe they can use that headshot to get their first job or, you know, to get back on their feet. The reaction is usually a mix of tears and joy and hugs. And, you know, it's an overwhelming event for everybody involved. And It's just magic. It really is magic. It's hard to explain unless you see it for yourself and participate.
Did people talk to you about why they'd come?
Yeah, certainly. One of the most powerful stories for me this past December was working with a Palestinian woman who had come to the event, and she walked in with her five children. And I asked her, I said, why are you here? What brought you here today? And she said, a few weeks ago, my husband passed away of a sudden heart attack. And shortly after that, my son was almost killed from the war. A soldier had tried to run him over. And so I immediately left Palestine and gathered all my things and moved here to Seattle. And I don't know anybody. I don't know what I'm going to do. But when my husband was alive, we had never, ever had a family portrait taken. We don't have any pictures of us as a family. And so she said, I came here to get my first ever family picture. She said, I'm wondering if you could photograph my children and Photoshop my husband into the picture. And so we were able to do that. I photographed her family that day and brought home her husband's picture and Photoshopped him in. And so we were able to give her her first ever family portrait, as well as provide just a day of loving on her kids and spending time with them, which she said was another huge need. She had just been really living in a state of depression. So that's really what Help Portrait is all about.
Do you have any other stories like that?
Yeah, the 2009 event, there was a lady that came to the Nashville event, and she said that when she was a child, she was abused by her father. He used to torture her by dumping acid on her face. And so she has all these scars that she's had her entire life. And she's always dreamed of having one professional picture taken where there was enough hair and makeup that covered her scars. And so that day, for the first time, we were able to provide enough makeup where she could see herself without all her scars. And as you can imagine, everybody was in tears seeing her see herself for the first time in that light.
You give them an actual printed portrait. You're not digitizing these photos. You know, in this age of social networking and media all the time, you're not posting them on the internet.
Mm-hmm.
Could you talk a little bit about the significance of that or what that means?
Yeah. I think it's really important to talk about. I mean, it goes against everything in a photographer's mentality. You're right. I mean, we take pictures, we post them on Flickr, we get feedback and comments, we put them on Facebook, all that good stuff. But to tell photographers to say, go shoot these pictures, but then give them away and then get rid of them. Like, we want to respect the privacy of those we're shooting. And this isn't about us anyway. This isn't about our portfolios or our lighting or our talent. This is simply about serving.
And I think also it lends a sort of tangibility to it,
mm-hmm.
in holding that picture in your hand.
Yeah, there really is a major difference in looking at an image on a screen and holding a print in your hand. Holding a print in your hand is way more magic. And in fact, we have literally seen people walking down the street weeks and weeks later, even months later after the Help Portrait event, still holding that picture. You know, a lot of people say, well, why would you give a print to a homeless person? And you wouldn't believe what that means to them.
Jeremy Cowart is the founder of Help Portrait, a nonprofit group of photographers working with those in need around the U.S. and 50 countries around the world. The unrest in the Middle East is also causing a huge refugee crisis. And as history has shown, many of these refugees may never return home. The largest refugee camp in the world is at Dadaab in eastern Kenya. Almost all of the 270,000 refugees fled there from the conflict in neighboring Somalia. This September, the camp will have been opened for 20 years. But as reporter Nick Wadhams found out during a recent visit, no one is celebrating the upcoming milestone.
Dadaab may be huge, but it makes its presence known slowly. After a couple hours of hard driving on a dirt road where camel caravans provide the only company, you come to a derelict checkpoint. A soldier sitting in the shade waves you through and goes back to chatting with the friends who have come to keep him company. Beyond the checkpoint is the town of Dadaab. That's how the camp gets its name. The refugees here actually live in three locations that orbit Dadaab, like oversized moons around an asteroid. If you counted them together, these camps would be Kenya's fourth largest city. Each one feels a lot like a city, too. They have internet cafes, pharmacies, auto repair shops, and bus depots. But then, people have had a long time to get settled in. I'll admit it, the first thing I think when I get here is, hey, this isn't so bad. The refugees seem well fed. Many live in clean mud brick homes in compounds surrounded by high walls of thickly bunched sticks. Walking down the quiet sandy lanes between those walls, Dadaab almost feels serene. These same thoughts occurred to me when I met Mohammed Dahir, who came to Dadaab in 1994. Dahir is a camp elder, and his home reflects his status. The walls of his compound are covered with hundreds of USAID vegetable oil tins, flattened out and hammered together. The tops of oil drums have been cut off, sliced in half, painted blue or green or red, and then laid around the buildings as decoration. We sit on straw mats under the shade of a tree where a cool breeze blows. I'm tempted to compliment him for his home, but then he shows me his ID card, and I begin to understand the quiet agony of Dadaab. The ID was issued by the Somali National Refugee Agency in 1986, back when Somalia received refugees instead of producing them. Dahir had been a farmer in Ethiopia and fled government persecution in 1984. 5 years later, he fled Somalia. I study the picture on the card. The young Dahir wore a serious, intent expression. He was balding, but the hair he had was still black, his face unlined. Now I look up at the man in front of me. Dahir's hair is now gray, and his face bears wrinkles of age and hard living. He looks much older than his 56 years. Suddenly, remarking on his home seems inappropriate. I did not choose the life of a refugee, Dahir tells me, but it chose him. He has been one for almost half his life. After speaking with him, I start to understand something I've felt since I arrived but had not been able to place. There is a suffocating sense here that Dadaab's refugees are all doing one thing, waiting. They are waiting for Somalia's war to end. They are waiting to be resettled in a foreign country. They are waiting for the chance to be anywhere but in Dadaab. Some of the refugees waiting here have gone to school, gotten married, and raised children. The UN says there are now 6,000 grandchildren of the original arrivals, the people who came that first year in 1991. Like Dahir, many will grow old waiting here, and as the cemetery near his home attests, some will die waiting here. After I say goodbye to Dahir and leave Dadaab a few days later, I pass several big buses coming the other way. They're filled with refugees who had secured movement passes for trips outside the camp and are now returning. I think I see the same sadness on their faces that I'd seen on Dahir's. They're coming back to Dadaab. They're coming back to wait.
Nick Wadhams is a reporter for Bloomberg News and is now based in China. Coming up on the World Vision Report, the challenges refugees face when they do move back home. I'm Melinda Penkava. This is the World Vision Report. As we heard a moment ago, the refugee camp in Dadaab, Kenya has become a near permanent residence for hundreds of thousands of refugees. For refugees who manage to move back home, wherever home may be, the transition can be complicated. Take, for example, one family in Sri Lanka. About 2 years ago, the Sri Lankan army defeated the rebel Tamil Tigers and ended a quarter century of a bloody civil war. Afterward, the government forced about 300,000 civilians into heavily guarded camps. Those trying to escape were shot. Many Tamils are still being held. The Johnson family considers themselves lucky. They spent 18 months behind the barbed wire before being allowed to return home. Rick Wasserman met them in their village in Sri Lanka's northern Manar district.
It's early morning, and Jacinda Johnson is feeding the hens she recently bought. Her husband, Fernand, pulls up a water pail from the family's newly repaired well. Their three youngest children are getting ready for school.
Yes, we're back after being in the camp for so long. But my oldest son was seriously injured, and now my husband has to do all the farm work.
Still, Jacinda knows they're lucky. The Johnsons' village, Sinipandivirichan, is in an area once controlled by the Tamil Tigers. When the Sri Lankan army began its final assault on the rebels, their community came under heavy fire. Villagers fled to a refugee camp. It, too, was bombed. Thousands there died. The Johnsons survived, but they were forced to stay in a dirty, overcrowded camp for a year and a half. Finally, they were permitted to return home. They came back to find the jungle had moved in. Heavy growth now covers nearly all of their fields. Fernand has started clearing the land and replanting banana trees. His eldest son, 20-year-old Anthony, was wounded during the war and can only look on.
I don't know what I'll do now. My shattered leg is a big problem. Finding a job will be hard.
And there are no jobs here in Sinipandivirichan. The Johnsons, like thousands of other Tamils, receive support from the United Nations Agency for Refugees, the UNHCR. It's giving returnees 25,000 rupees, or about $220, and 6 months of dry rations. Then they're on their own. Jacinda prepares tea in the tiny kitchen beside her small wooden mud house. Inside, her two teenage daughters are studying. Jacinda looks tired. She sighs often. Then she looks up, pointing at her new corrugated roof, a gift from a local NGO, throws a glance at her two teenage daughters packing their school books in the yard, and smiles.
There is so much for us to plan for now, especially getting my children educated and getting my daughters married.
After more than 2 years, this classroom in the Sinipandivirichan school is once again filled with young voices. The Johnson's 12-year-old son, Dayasin, is busy with a school project, nailing together a drying rack.
When we came back, we asked for the school to open soon. They did, and I'm happy, but I still think often of my friend who died in the shelling.
Dayasin's school was the site of a fierce battle between the government and Tamil Tigers in August 2008. Students and teachers fled in panic. Father Seaman, pastor in the Roman Catholic Church across the street from the school, remembers.
19 people were killed, 3 teachers and 2 helpers and 1 driver and all the students. Many of them were baptized by me.
The memories of that horrific incident linger. But daily life in Sinipandivirichan is slowly getting back to normal. Roads are being repaired, houses are being rebuilt. Yet the signs of war remain. The village contains about a dozen bombed-out homes, unoccupied. Their owners gone or dead. Government troops still patrol the village, searching for Tamil tiger guerrillas in hiding. The school day is coming to an end. All the children line up to sing. It's a reminder that despite the trauma of war, the Tamil culture remains strong. Back home, Fernand has planted the last of the banana trees. He waters them, hoping they'll thrive in their new spot. In the evening, the family sets out their best clothes for morning mass. Entrance to Maru Church, Father Seaman looks out over the parishioners, but he's not at the altar. Instead, two other priests lead the Mass. One speaks Tamil and the other Sinhalese. It's a hopeful sign that things may be changing here in the post-war north of Sri Lanka, that reconciliation might just be possible. For the World Vision Report, I'm Rick Wasserman in northern Sri Lanka.
Uganda is desperately in need of surgeons. In a country of 32 million people, there are only about 100 surgeons who are specialists. As a result, accident victims with critical injuries must sometimes wait weeks or months for operations. One reason for this lack of surgeons is medical students in Uganda are increasingly choosing to work in the better-paying field of HIV and AIDS care. Bonnie Allen has our story.
Inside Uganda's largest government hospital, Dr. Patrick Sakimpi pounds a metal rod through a woman's broken thigh bone, then tightens it down with screws. His operating room is not a place for anyone with a sensitive stomach.
Very gentle. That's the boy.
Sakimpi compares it to a carpenter's workshop, complete with hammers, screwdrivers, and drills.
I like being a bone doctor because of the fact that you get immediate results if you do the right stuff. Unlike medicine, where you're going to give someone a drug, you don't know where it's going to work. Here you fix the fracture. If you fix it well, tomorrow the patient is walking, and every time you see him, he's better.
But that sense of satisfaction isn't enough to attract new doctors into this surgical field. Sakimpi is one of only 26 orthopedic surgeons in Uganda, which works out to just one surgeon for every 1.2 million people. This in a country with one of the highest rates of road accidents in the world. To understand the problem, one needs only to walk through Mulago Hospital. It's so overcrowded that patients lie on blood-soaked mattresses on the floor.
All the wards are full. They are full of patients that are waiting for surgery. Sometimes the backlog extends so that someone stays for a month or 6 weeks before having the surgery.
Just ask 50-year-old Amran Kazala.
Up to today, it's now 2.5 months.
That's how long he's been waiting for surgery since he broke his leg in a motorcycle accident. He's a tailor, but has been unable to work since he injured himself. I ask him who's supporting his 10 children.
Only God knows.
The leg is broken.
In another ward, a 3-year-old girl who was hit by a car is recovering from emergency surgery. Her mother says she had to wait 8 days for it, lying in her own feces because of a ruptured bowel. The hospital is full of such stories, but despite the overwhelming need for surgeons, Sakimpi says doctors are increasingly drawn to another healthcare crisis in Uganda.
The doctors find the work in HIV more lucrative, so most of the young doctors now are going for HIV projects and HIV-related work because there's good pay, good working conditions.
Uganda was the epicenter of the AIDS epidemic in the 80s. Unlike most African countries, it quickly sought help from outside the country. Today, about 90% of funding for HIV/AIDS comes from international donors. And the money covers everything from pharmaceuticals and medical equipment to doctors' salaries. An HIV specialist can earn twice as much as a surgeon. For 24-year-old medical student Magumba Caesar, it's too appealing to resist.
I believe when I finish, I will get much money as compared to what I get in the government.
On this day, in a suburb not far from the hospital, Dr. Baharani is on duty at a donor-funded HIV clinic. The lanky young doctor is counseling an HIV-positive man suspected of having tuberculosis. The clinic is well-stocked with medical supplies, so Ronnie can easily order blood tests or prescribe free drugs to patients. Ugandan doctors like Ronnie, who've chosen work in the HIV/AIDS field, defend their choice. More than 1 million people live with the virus in Uganda, and in 2009, 64,000 people died from AIDS-related illnesses. So for him, says Ronnie, it's not about the money.
I'd seen several of my family members suffer from HIV, and I felt by I being in there, I would probably offer a better option for my relatives rather than having to send them to other people.
Still, he confirms that in a race to recruit new doctors, HIV projects have a clear advantage over government surgical departments.
With surgery, the working conditions around the country are not really the best. They wouldn't be the ones that would really encourage someone to go into that field.
Back in the operating room, Sakimpi says he isn't surprised at the lack of interest. Many of his surgeries are cancelled because the government hospital doesn't have the essentials, oxygen, blood, and sterilized equipment. Sometimes there aren't even any anesthesiologists to sedate the patients. And despite 4 years of additional training after medical school, surgeons are poorly paid for work that can be dangerous. As if to illustrate the point, Sakimpi suddenly steps away from a patient on the operating table, yanks back his hand, and shouts.
So my glove is torn.
His voice is a bit muffled behind his green mask, but he tells me that a bone shard has sliced his thin glove.
We're working on bloody cases. Blood is flying around. So there's a risk that you may contract HIV and hepatitis and other diseases.
The Ugandan Health Ministry acknowledges the lack of surgeons is a big problem. Amandu Jacinto oversees patient care in the country. He says Uganda only introduced surgical services 10 years ago, so the developing country is still building up its equipment and staffing. But Jacinto says he's pushing for change. He recently drafted a proposal to hire more surgeons and triple their salaries.
Hopefully, taking the discussions at both cabinet and ministry level, there will be enhancement of salaries for health workers. We're expecting a reply by June in the next budget.
But he warns it will take time to train more surgeons and improve working conditions. That may be too late for Patrick Sakimpi.
I cannot continue working when things are not working.
Sakimpi's passion is farming, and he says he may eventually give up surgery for less stressful work on his farm. That, of course, would leave Uganda short one more orthopedic surgeon. For the World Vision Report, I'm Bonnie Allen in Kampala, Uganda.
The World Bank recently reported that rocketing prices for wheat, corn, and rice have plunged another 44 million people into extreme poverty. These are all foods that are traded globally. But in India, food prices have risen as much as 17% on food sold for local consumption, such as vegetables, eggs, and dairy products. Vikas Bajaj is the Mumbai correspondent for the New York Times. He recently wrote a series that explained what is going on with food in India and why the rise of India's middle class is a factor.
The population is growing and people have more money, so they're spending more money on more of the kinds of things that they didn't spend on before, like vegetables. The other thing is supply. The supply hasn't been really keeping up with demand.
This year's extreme weather in India hit farmers hard. In the western part of the country, monsoons lasted a month longer than usual, which caused a huge crop of onions to rot in the ground. Vikas Bajaj says Indian farmers face two major challenges.
Most Indian farmers don't have irrigation in their fields. They don't have access to canals, or they don't have access to systems that could irrigate their fields in a proper sort of adequate manner. The other thing is that they don't have the kind of technology, the basic technology, that would prevent them from suffering big losses when it rains too much, for instance. They don't have drainage trenches. They don't have a place to store their crops. So you don't have anything that could sort of create the kinds of buffer that other countries have, that developed nations have.
There are high-tech irrigation systems that carefully measure soil moisture and deliver water exactly where and when it's needed. But those are relatively expensive and out of reach for many Indian farmers. Bajaj reported on one low-tech solution that might do the trick more cheaply.
I talked to an entrepreneur in California who runs a company called DripTech, and DripTech makes really cheap plastic pipes and punches holes in them with a laser and connects them to a barrel of water that can sit on a stool or a bench and irrigate fields that way. And it's very, very, very cheap. It's certainly not very sophisticated, and it has other drawbacks that, you know, you could address with a more complicated system. But, you know, this system can be had for less than $200 for half an acre.
How much of a difference would that make for the farmer?
It could make a pretty substantial difference. I mean, the numbers vary by crop, but in some cases, you know, you could have double or three times the production in the same field with a drip irrigation system than you do with traditional flood irrigation systems.
Now, if farmers had access to some of the solutions that you're talking about here, better irrigation and maybe better distribution system, could the small-scale farmers feed the country? Could India feed itself then?
Yeah, most definitely. I mean, India, by and large, India feeds itself. It's increasingly importing oil, for instance, cooking oil. It's increasingly importing lentils and beans. But by and large, India has been able to feed itself at a very sort of subsistence level. And there's no reason that India can't feed itself at a higher level. India has the second most quantity of arable land after the United States. So there's no reason that India can't feed itself. And, you know, some people believe that India should not only be able to feed itself, but it could feed the world. It already exports, for instance, a lot of basmati rice, which is a sort of a high-quality rice that a lot of people enjoy in Indian restaurants in the U.S. So there's no reason that small-scale farming can't achieve those results.
That was Vikas Bajaj, Mumbai correspondent for The New York Times. You can find his series of articles on India's farmers on our website at worldvisionreport.org.
Welcome to The Global Guru. I'm Rachel Louise Snyder. This week we ask one simple question, just one from somewhere in the world. Today we're in Tanzania asking, what's with all the barbershops?
When I got there, I could not help but notice that there were many, many, many of these barbershops on what seemed to be virtually every street.
This is Brad Weiss, a professor of cultural anthropology at William & Mary. In the late 90s, he saw growing numbers of barbershops in Tanzania, sometimes a dozen in a single block.
What struck me about them initially was how incredibly vital they were. That is, there was a lot of activity that was going on around them, how many there were, and how colorful they were.
They were a result, Weiss says, of the Soviet Union's collapse when Tanzania became a liberal democracy and looked west for influence, not east.
And this brought about what in Swahili was called mageuzi, which means changes. And along with the changes in the political structure, there were also changes in what we might think of as the social and cultural organization. You could get things like Vibe and People Magazine and Ebony. So along with these global media came images of hip-hop. It's not unusual to see music videos that are filmed in and around barbershops. They're places where black men and images of masculinity are really celebrated and a kind of masculine solidarity.
Tanzania was smitten with hip-hop, which brought barbershops. And economically, barbershops can flourish without training, overhead, or infrastructure.
They look like little closets, or if they're really big, they look like perhaps a one-car garage. And there might be a chair in a very small barbershop. There might be two chairs in a sort of medium-sized barbershop.
Weiss compares them to locker rooms.
And locker rooms, by definition, have a sort of obvious masculinity about them. And they are the sort of thing where people kid around with each other and they joke around with each other. They talked a lot about jobs. Nobody is in a barbershop because they want to be a barber.
So if they don't want to be barbers, why do so many men open them?
They're in a barbershop because they're looking to hold on until something that's more concrete, that's going to really provide an opportunity for them, comes along. And a barbershop might be the kind of place where you would hear the information that you would need in order to make that future for yourself.
But what about the patrons? Is there that much call for a shave and a trim?
I could sit in many a barbershop for many a day without seeing a customer show up for a haircut.
So shops aren't about the product or the vendor.
Barbershops are places for people to imagine themselves to be part of a wider world.
More ahead on the World Vision Report. You're listening to the World Vision Report. I'm Melinda Pencava. Bolivia is often called the poorest nation in South America. And in Bolivia's indigenous culture, if you do happen to have money, it's generally considered bad taste to flaunt it. Except at Gran Poder, an opulent street party held each year around the summer solstice. Wealthier residents sponsor the party so everyone can join in. Economists estimate up to $40 million are spent each year on the merrymaking. Reporter Annie Murphy takes us there.
Gran Poder has taken over the neighborhood of the same name. Tens of thousands of people line these narrow, hilly streets, dressed up in their best. Sharp suits, bowler hats, and lots of colorful sequins. Some are playing music, some are eating and drinking, and others, like Marta Mercado, are dancing.
I've danced since I was a little girl. We need to praise God, and our way of doing it is to dance.
This party did begin a century ago as a religious festival, celebrated in the church that's a shrine to Jesus de Gran Poder, the patron of the celebration. The neighborhood of Gran Poder has always been home to La Paz's small merchants, indigenous people who came from the countryside and scraped by. About 100 years ago, they started to pray to a late 17th century painting of Jesus, asking him for success in their work, hoping for better times ahead. And they created this festival, Gran Poder, which means big power, to honor him. Over the years, some of the merchants got richer. They began to sell sewing machines, then radios, then TVs. Today, you can even find computers and other high-tech gadgets in local stores. Marta Mercado says all that success is reflected in the glitter of Gran Poder.
Now there are women who wear the most expensive hats, gold jewelry. Some women might spend up to $8,000 on their attire. It's the gold jewelry that's the most expensive. A woman who really wants to show off will dress like that.
But Grand Poder isn't just a show of money and status. The wealthy in the neighborhood subsidize the party for those who can't afford the festivities. Merchant Ruben Segales has made it big. He leans on his new SUV with two friends smoking cigarettes. The street is full of electronics for sale, including some huge TVs showing an American basketball game. Ruben and his friends are the patrons of a dance group.
Not everything should be work. There needs to be a moment of happiness. So when a person becomes a patron, they begin to invest, to spend money on the musicians, on the tailors.
Ruben and other merchants will also pay for the elaborate food, the flow of drinks, special party favors, even waiters in tuxedos who will serve cocktails and snacks while participants aren't dancing. He sees these donations as an act of faith and an offering to Jesus de Gran Poder that will help ensure Ruben's future prosperity. But 28-year-old Rosemary Lisco scrimped all year to buy her purple satin shawl and skirt. Rosemary is a peddler who travels from city to city hawking tea kettles and dish towels. Today she's in a makeshift beauty salon, a curtain and a stool, getting her nails painted before dancing.
Grand Poder is about status and prestige. It's important to be part of a dance group, so you're willing to save and prepare for this day all year long because it's special.
Rosemary checks her nails and makeup and runs to join her group. They wind down the hill, a mass of swirling petticoats and dapper suits. Thousands of splendidly dressed merchants who have put faith and money on this party so they will have economic prosperity in the coming year. In La Paz, Bolivia, this is Annie Murphy for the World Vision Report.
Reporter Annie Murphy is based in Brazil.
Hi, I'm Jorge Derbich from La Paz, Bolivia, and you are listening to the World Vision Report.
Mexico, the famous Copper Canyon Railway carves its way through the northern state of Chihuahua. It's a marvel of engineering and a huge tourist attraction. But what happens when something goes wrong? Well, our Mexico correspondent Grant Fuller spent a day with a railroad worker in San Rafael who cleans up after train derailments. And as Grant discovered, this job requires a serious love of the tracks.
When I find Heriberto Castro on the control deck of an ancient crane, he looks right at home. With a boyish grin beneath his mustache, he pulls a greasy lever to sound the horn. He says the toot of the horn marks the start of a day's work and the end, when he celebrates another victory, another day without having to respond to a train wreck. 37-year-old Castro is the crane operator in San Rafael. When a train derails, he's in charge of clearing the tracks of boxcars and debris. Like a doctor on call, he's always ready. After Castro turns off the engine and scrambles down from his perch, he runs into a friend on the short walk back to the metal container he calls home. Yep, he actually lives on the tracks, within the confines of an old boxcar. Castro welcomes both of us into his makeshift house. The workday is done. Now he's eager to relax and shoot the breeze. As we sit on plastic chairs by a camping stove in the tiny, sparse kitchen, the conversation quickly turns into a series of remember whens about train accidents. When it's time to turn in, Castro winds down with a little music from the stereo in his cubicle-like bedroom. He gives me the extra bedroom, separated from his by a sheet of plywood. Come morning, it's chorizo and eggs for breakfast. As we chow down, Castro tells me about his family, For them, trains are life, always have been.
Empieza desde mi abuelo, Cecilio, desde mi tío Santiago, mi padre Abraham Castro.
Castro ticks off the names of his family members who've lived this same way. His grandfather, his father, an uncle, and three brothers.
Puedes salir en la madrugada, días festivos, en el cumpleaños de la mamá o X cosa, ¿verdad?
Even at midnight, on holidays, or on your birthday, he says, we have to be ready for action, so we live our life on the tracks. That means limited time with his wife and kids. They live a couple hours away, and he sees them only on weekends.
Listo. Yep. Vámonos, pues.
Tall and sturdy, Castro heads to work wearing a bright orange reflective vest and hard hat. Out of the corner of my eye, I spot him make a quick sign of the cross and kiss his work glove. We reach the massive railroad crane. It's the size of a big tour bus. And I follow him up the ladder. Like a race car driver slipping in behind the wheel, Castro's clearly in his comfort zone. Castro sings while he works. To make sure the 100-year-old crane doesn't turn into a rusting hulk, he checks it every day, down to the smallest detail. Castro's grandfather used to maintain the same crane, and the intricate knowledge of the machine's inner workings has been passed down to him. As he scrubs all the crane's bells and whistles and talks about the engine, Castro sounds more like a proud parent than a crane operator. For the most part, his job is to hurry up and wait. And truth is, it looks pretty boring. But then, Castro starts to sing again, and I realize there's nowhere else he'd rather be.
¿Será que a lo mejor llevo la sangre de mi padre que él siempre estuvo así trabajando en el ferrocarril? A lo mejor me transmitió la misma emoción, el mismo sentimiento, ¿ah?
Maybe I've got my father's blood, he says. He must have passed it on to me, that emotional connection to the railroad. For the World Vision Report, I'm Grant Fuller in San Rafael, Mexico.
It's been a year since the big oil spill devastated coastal communities along the Gulf of Mexico. And because they're so dependent on that local economy, the Cajun community in Louisiana was hit especially hard. Cajun band Steve Riley and the Mamou Playboys recently released an album called Grand Isle, reflecting on what's been lost. We're hearing here the title track from Grand Isle. It's about a magical island off the coast of Louisiana hit hard by the spill. Steve Riley and David Greeley joined me from a studio in Lafayette, Louisiana to talk about the album, and David Greeley explained why he wrote the song.
When I was a kid, we used to go camping on the beach at Grand Isle. It was one of my favorite places to go. I'd spend a lot of time in the water. What's in this song describes when I was 9 years old, I used to walk out on the bridge and you could stand out there and watch the dolphins gorging themselves on shrimp right there underneath you. It was just a real great childhood memory. When the oil disaster occurred last spring, it really weighed heavily on my mind because I knew that that oil was headed right for Grand Isle.
And as recently as mid-January, there are oil balls coming up on the beach there.
There's still there's a sheen in the water. There's tar balls coming up. The marshes are still full of oil. There's oil in the reeds and the marshes and oil sheen coming out of the recesses of the marsh.
The BP oil spill wasn't the first time that the people of Louisiana and the Cajun people in Louisiana have faced disasters. There were, of course, the two hurricanes, Katrina and Rita. And I'd just like to back up a few hundred years. The Cajuns, they're a group who originally came from France, and they migrated first to Nova Scotia and then fled to Louisiana. And the hundreds of years since haven't been easy either. Are there parts of Cajun history that stand out to you?
Well, yeah, there are several phases of struggle for survival. To start with, in the early 1600s, they were... I visited a museum in France that's dedicated to the Acadians, and it's in a beautiful little part of central western France that's known historically as Poitou. Really nice place. And I asked the lady, I said, why did they leave here? It seems like a nice place to live. She said, well, they left because they were starving. Agricultural practices were really primitive. They had to pay a whole lot of what they grew to the landowner for the privilege of working his land. So when they were offered land in North America, Nova Scotia, they took it, even though it was pretty risky and they had to leave everything they knew behind. They went over there for the chance of having a better life, and which they did have for several generations until they lost it again.
Mm-hmm.
What happened then was when the British took over Nova Scotia. They considered the Acadian people that lived there to be insolent, and I suppose they were insolent. They didn't want to be told who their king was or what they were supposed to do or how to behave. And after many, many years, the British finally just kicked them out. They had an ethnic cleansing in that area and hauled everyone off that was Acadian. They put them on boats and scattered them, and some of them came to Louisiana and started a new society here.
It's a world of hurt there, and I'm wondering how that finds its way into your music. Can you identify places where that shows up in the Cajun music?
Well, most of our music reflects that. I mean, a lot of the songs we play are really old songs, and though they sound happy, the lyrics are as sad as can be. And that shows you that, you know, we were going through a hard time and still have hard times, and singing about your hard times makes you feel better.
With the oil spill as a backdrop, a few titles of the songs on the new CD seem as though they might be commenting on frustration with these past few years of disasters. And one song that comes to mind there is C'est trop, it's too much. Is that alluding to this is just beyond the pale, this has gone too far?
Exactly, yeah. I had a wonderful lyricist working with me on that song. His name is Barry Ancelet. I went to him with the idea. I was thinking about all that had happened and how we can express it, and he came up with it perfectly. You know, and he said, see if I can translate in my head. It's not the first time they've made us precious promises or the first time they've stolen and left us. It's too late to cry. It's just too late.
There's a song you have here on Grand Isle called C'est l'heure pour changer. It's time to change, time for a change. Do you see things changing in Louisiana?
There's definitely change going on, always down here and everywhere. And that song is just kind of calling together of, you know, everyone to get together. Change starts with people, you know. It starts with your attitude. It starts with how you feel inside and how you look at things and how you continue on in the midst of everything that's happening around you. And that's pretty much the meaning behind that song. You know, we're a simple people for the most part, and, you know, we live close to the bone. There's nothing fancy. You know, one thing that we do want to hold on to and take care of is our music, our way of life, the simple things that give us pleasure. And it's time for the rest of us to pick up the ball and keep it going. Keep the joy in the midst of all the chaos.
That's right.
Been listening to Steve Riley and David Greeley of Steve Riley and the Mamou Playboys. Their latest album commemorates the one-year anniversary of the Gulf oil spill. The CD is called Grand Isle, and you can find out more about it on our website at worldvisionreport.org. And that brings us to the end of our show today. Remember, you can find us on Facebook and Twitter, and you can download a podcast at our website, worldvisionreport.org. This program was produced by Susan Shepherd, filling in for Beverly Abel. Lita Hartman is the assignment editor. Christina Darden and Cynthia Graber produce our interviews. Jenny Schmidt and Julie Drizin edit the show. Doug Boyles is our audio engineer. Emily Eagle assists him. Chris Baldiga is the production assistant. Larry Short produces our website. Shelley Noe is our general manager. Thanks for listening. Filling in for Peggy Wehmeyer, I'm Melinda Pencava.
Support for this program comes from World Vision, building a better world for children. The views expressed on this show are not necessarily those of the organization.